Thank you, Robert. Last August 7th at Blossom Music Center, we had a debut with the Cleveland Orchestra. But it was hardly a debutante who appeared on our podium for the first time, but none other but Mitch Miller. We are happy to have had a chance to chat with that extraordinary musician, delightful human being, and great friend of the Cleveland Orchestra. Since everyone else seems to call you Mitch, maybe I'll be allowed to do the same.
I would feel embarrassed if you didn't, Klaus, so please do.
Mitch, your program at Blossom included three pieces by Gershwin, The American in Paris, The Concerto in F, The Rhapsody in Blue, the latter two with David Golub as soloist. Tell us first about your acquaintance and association with Gershwin.
Well, Klaus, in 1934, actually, I met Gershwin's sister, Frances Godofsky, in Rochester when Leopold Godofsky Jr., the son of the great pianist, was working there on Kodachrome. They invented color film.
Right.
And we used to play chamber music while I was a student at the Eastman School of Music in the late 20s. I graduated in 32, coming to New York, so Frances Godofsky, who was Frances Gershwin, got me an invitation, an introduction to her brother. And when he was going to go on tour, I auditioned for Charles Previn, who is Andre Previn's uncle, who was going to be the conductor. And he had a whole young orchestra. In fact, Harry Fuchs, the wonderful cellist of the Cleveland Orchestra, was solo cellist. The late David Dawson was solo viola. We had some of the best young musicians in the country. And we toured for 8 weeks of one-night stands. In fact, we played in Cleveland at the Public Auditorium.
Was that in Porgy and Bess?
No, this was in Gershwin playing Rhapsody in Blue.
I see.
The Concerto in F. He played some preludes on the piano, some of his preludes that he wrote, and we played American in Paris, everything. Tonight's program is exactly what we played with Gershwin, except he played more solos.
So you know how he wanted the piece to go?
Well, I know the feel he wanted. Actually, Gershwin was not a great pianist with his own works because he didn't like to practice. Oscar Levant played them very well in some sense. Of course, Golub played the concerto and the rhapsody, the best I ever heard in my life.
Really. Wonderful.
He has the understanding of jazz plus the power to project the piece. But Gershwin was he had such a feel for incorporating jazz into a large orchestra, and he was learning as he went along. Bill Daly, who was the conductor of the City Service Program and a good friend of George's, would help him with the orchestration, and George was not embarrassed by that. He would have them there, like in Porgy and Bess. Bill Daly says, this voicing doesn't work, George, change it. And he was a fast learner and a willing learner.
Well, after that, you got involved with Porgy and Bess, didn't you?
Yes, the following year, I played with Porgy and Bess, the original company. We opened in Boston for 2 weeks, and we came to New York for the Theater Guild. And I must say, the times have so much to do, Klaus, with the way a piece of music is accepted, because all the respected Broadway critics said it isn't a musical. The opera critics said yes. It isn't an opera.
Yeah.
So they consigned it through fiat, to a no man's land of what? What is it? And it was foolishness. They should have accepted
this
it for what it
was. This is very interesting. Our recent recording with Lauren Mazel conducting sees the work as an opera. The Houston recording, I understand, sees it as a musical. So these are two ways to do it.
Well, I think that it's in good company, yeah, because Carmen is thought of the same way.
Yes. Was Alexander Smolins the conductor?
Alex
at the time?
Smolins was the conductor, yes. And Alexander Smolins would come to the Lewison Stadium every summer. And there was the one night that they would have 30-some thousand people at the Lewison Stadium was the all Gershwin night.
Well, I saw the first revival in Boston in 1942, I think it was.
It was
I don't recall who conducted at the time. It may have been Smolins again, but it was a wonderful cast. Todd Duncan.
Tom Duncan and Ann Brown?
Ann Brown was still in it.
Mm-hmm.
And was it Cap Calloway? I forget.
Well, Buck and Bubbles were in the original.
Yeah, no, there must have been Cap Calloway,
yes.
I think. I think I got that right. That's a fantastic story, your association with Gershwin. We could spend our entire time on that, but we have so many other things to talk about. One, the program you gave at Blossom ended with one of your inimitable sing-alongs. Would you tell us how those got started and what you really mean to do with them?
Well, actually, it started as a record idea, Klaus. And then it worked its way out into television. And then when I began to conduct the symphony orchestra around the country, people asked, why don't you do a sing-along with the audience? So I said, why not? Singing is indigenous to every ethnic group that ever came to America. In fact, when we first came, you know, everyone, the Germans had their Sängerbunds, the Swedes had their singing societies, the Italians had their operas. And before radio, people would sing around the piano at home. So the idea is nothing new. It was just to present it in such a way that people could enjoy it. Well, we did this on records and then through television. And now at the concerts, as you heard, these audiences have a most instinctive feeling for music. They follow the conductor. They make fermatas. They make modulations.
They take risks with you.
Well, that's, you know, be at risk. Without risks, there's no great art. You have to shoot for the best. And if you have the equipment, most of the time you'll make it.
Well, some of the songs are really not known to the young people of today, are they? Some of these are old tunes.
Well, this is very interesting too, Klaus, because I see now more than half the people who come to my concerts are young people.
Hmm.
And I was curious, and of course it makes sense when I tell you this story. They said, oh, but you don't understand. When we were kids, we watched your television show and we sang with your records with our parents. And those were very happy, memorable moments for us. A Southern gal will say, oh, my daddy would hold me on his knee for the whole program every time. Well, now, what is every day happening as a child suddenly when you look back and you those indelible happiness moments remain in your mind, and those were some of the best for these people who are now grown up, and they look back at it with much love and nostalgia, and they're coming out to the concerts. When I conducted at the Hollywood Bowl, well, the UCLA had a whole contingent over there, and some were dancing for Hava Nagila. But it's the young people who are, I think, more responsible for my success today than anyone.
Well, that's wonderful. Maybe some of these old tunes, that some of them date back to the beginning of the century.
Well,
they will come back.
Well, they never left. Yes. Actually, they're the songs, the cream that has risen to the top of the milk, as it were.
Mitch, it's quite clear that communication with people is one of your main concerns. It probably always has been. Do you make any arbitrary distinction between popular music and that which some people consider unpopular, that is attracting fewer people?
No, I make no distinction except more people have enough talent to write a popular song than to write a great symphonic work. But the way you judge a piece of music is the way you judge any art. Is it excellently written? Then is it excellently played? And when you have a combination of the Cleveland Orchestra, now, for instance, Gershwin was considered not suitable for symphonic programs 50 years ago. Now it's every symphony orchestra plays it. And all I'm trying to say is a 32-bar song written by Richard Rodgers or Cole Porter or Jerome Kern is a work of art in itself, just like a mystery story may not be as great a piece of literature as Oedipus Rex, but on the other hand, for what it is, it is a piece of art.
All this has changed, you can see from the fact that Lauren Mazel ended a recent Severance Hall season of the Cleveland Orchestra with an American in Paris. Well, that's an unheard-of thing to do only 20 years ago.
That's right.
You've told the story about Horowitz going to hear Art Tatum and Karajan letting them out to hear Satchmo.
Yes.
Is this really... Well, classical musicians are beginning to understand that they have something to learn from the popular people.
The real jazz musicians have the feeling for a phrase. They have to, because they're improvising new tunes all the time, and if they don't phrase it right, the audience is not going to hear it.
Mitch, you've had a fabulous classical career yourself. Give us a quick outline from the age of 6 on.
Well, piano lessons on a square Chickering piano for about a year and a half. I played two-part inventions. I was playing a little Mozart, and I had a very good teacher, but every time she leaned over, and talk to me. She had such bad breath. And I just didn't have the nerve to tell my parents, you know, to hurt her feelings.
So that's why you took up the cigar as a counterattack.
Counterattack,
right?
Yes. And so I stopped the piano. But then the public school music system in Rochester was one of the first to give instruments to the students. George Eastman bought the instruments. The school provided the instruction. I applied. All they had left was the oboe at age 11. So that became my instrument. I really attacked it in the sense that it's an instrument, if you don't master it, masters you. And if you have one of the great oboe players of the world in John Mack here. And I marvel at him. You know, Klaus, it's easier to conduct than play the oboe.
Oh, it probably must be.
No,
it's not as fallible a situation.
Exactly. Yes. The orchestra collectively never lets you down. And to play every night, some days you don't feel well, the reeds aren't good, the weather isn't right. But the idea of conducting, to me, is always, well, I leapt ahead again, because let me finish my fast history.
Well, you know, we had a clarinet player here about 40 years ago who once said to a guest conductor who was getting in trouble, he says, "Now don't worry, maestro, we play, you just follow."
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Well, there was the oboe in your career, and
yes,
how?
Then at age 15, I was playing second oboe in the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra. My teacher took sick, and for one season I played first oboe under conductors such as Fritz Reiner and Sir Thomas Beecham, Eugene Goossens. So I was played in
whose brother Leon was a pretty good oboist
very
himself.
Good. And I also played in Albert Coates' conducting class, so I got some tips on conducting from a very famous maestro. And I went on. I graduated from school, came to New York, no jobs. I went on WPA with an orchestra, and then the tour with George Gershwin, Porgy and Bess. And then I auditioned for solo oboe with the CBS Symphony, and I was engaged there. And I was there till 1950, and I played all kinds of chamber music with the Budapest Quartet, Lehner Quartet.
And your English horn playing wasn't bad either, I remember.
Oh, that's yes, recorded with Stokey. Swan of Tunella and the New World Symphony.
You know, Mitch, we could really spend an hour or so talking. Our time is running a little short. I've got to ask you one other thing. In recent years, of course, you've expanded your career as a conductor with many, many major orchestras and also some minor ones. But in addition, you like to see them healthy and happy, so you helped them in many ways, as for instance in our WCLV Orchestra Marathon last spring. You did a lot of things during your visit here and offered all kinds of wonderful premiums to the orchestra, some of which you redeemed at the time you came to Blossom Last, including cooking, wasn't
it? Yes, I cooked two dinners.
Fantastic. Now, there are yet other ways in which you help orchestras. Would you just quickly tell us? There is a way to do it in rehearsing, not as much rehearsing as you do performing.
Oh, yes. Well, when you get to a great orchestra like the Cleveland Orchestra, sure, we had only one rehearsal, but this orchestra is so disciplined and so musical and so rare that you don't rehearse for yourself. You only rehearse the very necessary things. In fact, you even don't rehearse some of those because you know that if you don't wear them out in the afternoon, you're going to get some performance in the evening, and they watch you like a hawk, and they really perform for you.
At some other places, you've done a very smart thing. You have the usual rehearsal or a little less, and then you give the same program several times, which then becomes a money-making proposition.
Oh, yes, yes. Now, for instance, you're right, like in Minnesota, I go there, rehearse once, and four sold-out performances. And so with the orchestra management, see, every service costs the same, whether it's rehearsal or concert. A symphony orchestra has 8 services a week. Well, out of 5 services, 4 are earners for me, whereas some great guest conductor may come and a fantastic musician. Well, 4 rehearsals
and one concert.
And one concert. There's only one earner.
I wish we had time to talk about your career as a record executive. One of these days we must do that, because that's a story of its own. Your years as a mover and shaker at Columbia and previous to that at Mercury. I'm sure we'll have the chance to do that. As you can see, it's tremendous fun talking with this man. It's a shame we can't go on for an hour or two. But Mitch Miller is off to somewhere else to make music and to make others love music nearly as much as he does. So many thanks for being our guest today, and thanks for being, as always, yourself. And now, back to Robert Conrad.